Well, hi, how are you? How's everything going? Good morning, welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. It's very nice to have you with us on this Wednesday, the 3rd of September, 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock, and a delight to have you here. We welcome you in more ways than one, not only to be listening to the program, but to be interacting with us. All you have to do is write to us if you would like to. Panel at WAMC.org is how you do that. Panel at WAMC.org. And we make an attempt to get to as many of the letters as we possibly can. I will tell you right now, we won't get to all of them, but we certainly try to get to the lion's share as well as kind of get the mood of the room from the letters that we get each and every day. We have a great panel today. Let me introduce them to you, and we will get started on the stories that we have for this Wednesday. First, we welcome Albany Law School professor and director of the Edward Swire Justice Center at Albany Law School, Sarah Rogerson. Good morning, Sarah.
How Good morning. Are you? I'm all right.
Good to see you. Thank you very much for being here, as always. We welcome Jay Jochniewicz, editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I'm well. I don't know if I can do well. Why not? So I was thinking about the show today, last night.
Yes.
And
you planned?
No. But this
don't start that trend.
This one sentence always comes through my mind when I think about the show and think about just being in social situations and situations where you have to talk. It's a line from a play, and I don't remember what play it is. And that's what's been driving me nuts for about 20 years. It's a boy and a girl talking about the prospect of getting married someday, and they say, but what will we talk about? You know, the idea of being married for a long time or coming on a show every day. Yeah. Whatever will we talk about, Joe?
Whatever will we talk about?
But if any of your readers know where that line comes from, it's something along those lines.
It sounds Our Town-ish, but I don't know.
I thought it was Our Town, too. I have searched Our Town for those words, and I can't find it.
All right. Well, you know what? Our listeners are on it.
Excellent.
I will tell you that.
I love them.
We have a newbie in the room. Not really. He's been with us before, but it's great to have him back as a panelist, and we're thrilled to welcome him to our ranks. Founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College. Whatever will we talk about? Roger Berkowitz is here. Good morning, Roger. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Really good to have you. Thank you very much for doing this and for being here. I do appreciate it. All right, let's go to the docket, as it were, and talk about things. A lot going on, and we'll try to put it. What I'm finding that's very interesting because of this deluge, the daily deluge of news, is that it's harder to find. I don't know if you noticed this, Jay, but it seems like you see like the top 10 stories on the Washington Post and the top 10 stories on New York Times, and they used to be similar, mm-hmm. and now they're not. and I find that, I mean, there's some similarities, but it's just there's so much, and people have their exclusives and they're doing stuff, so you sort of all allow that to brew, and of mm-hmm. course with all of the other, I was just using two out of many news sources, but just to give you an idea of where we are.
Well, it's just a hefty list today.
It is a very
I scrolled through it and I was like, wow,
hefty.
Joe doesn't usually give us this much homework.
No, I don't, and I've been adding some stories just because some things that I want to throw in every once in a while that things sort of connect with one another. I thought we'd go to the Pentagon judge's plan, especially with Sarah with us today. So the Pentagon plans for 600 military lawyers to backfill immigration judges. The Trump administration intends for hundreds of judge advocates general, or JAGs, to temporarily ease the overwhelming immigration caseload as law enforcement raids fill court dockets. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has tasked the branches of the armed services with finding up to 600 military lawyers to serve as temporary immigration judges in response to a request for assistance from the Department of Homeland Security. Two people familiar with the request told the Washington Post. The Pentagon is looking to identify military lawyers known as Judge Advocates General across active duty services, the National Guard, and the reserves to step in as judges to support immigration or law enforcement court proceedings. The Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration is already filling some court dockets, and both the military and the Department of Homeland Security are looking for ways to support extended operations in Chicago and other American cities, which we will be talking about in some depth later on in the program. I watched that JAG show for like three seasons. I never saw this coming up. This was not one of the story arcs.
No, because it's illegal. You can't. It's not something. So there's four things.
Yes.
Maybe I'll just start with four. The first is it's important contextually for everyone to understand that immigration judges, although they're federal, they're not Article III constitutionally appointed judges. They are in the executive branch. They are part of the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice seal hangs above their heads while they're making decisions every day in front of Department of Justice lawyers against usually an unrepresented immigrant unless they have found counsel through an organization or nonprofit. There is no guaranteed right to counsel. There's no defense counsel. And these are civil courts, not criminal courts. If there are criminal charges pending for any immigrant in the United States, those are processed separately and independently, typically through either federal courts, if it's a federal crime, or in the state court system, in the criminal courts. So immigration courts are these weird, special, it's not even, I don't even think it's fair to call it a judicial branch, even though I have a lot of respect for a lot of immigration lawyers, because it does sit in the executive. It is unique in that way. The second thing is, this is not going to be temporary. Apparently, the legal part of it is that any lawyer can serve as an immigration judge for a period of 6 months. So that's the hook. That's what the Trump administration is trying to use, because they're saying, well, these are lawyers. They just happen to be military lawyers. So that brings me to the third point, which is the militarization and the further it's an appearance thing. It's making immigrants look like a security threat to the United States as opposed to a boon to actual reduction of crime and a boon to our economy, which the actual statistical information bears out. And then there's also an article in Mother Jones that I was looking to that quotes a military expert, a former Air Force JAG and a law professor at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles, who says this appointment would be unlawful. This is Rachel Van Landingham, says this would be unlawful because turning military lawyers into immigration judges would likely violate the Posse Comitatus Act, a federal law that bars U.S. troops from participating in civil law enforcement or, quote unquote, executing the laws unless otherwise authorized to do so by the Constitution or Congress. So Congress would have to, if the period extends beyond 6 months, allegedly, if we believe in the rule of law anymore, or if anyone can restrain Trump, or if a federal judge intervenes, which I'm sure will happen in some way, shape, or form, Congress would have to amend the Immigration and Nationality Act to specifically allow or appoint or somehow finagle JAG military personnel to serve as immigration judges. I imagine that would be challenged as unconstitutional as well. So another day, another unconstitutional, unlawful, violent, and, you know, I'm sure probably racist in some way attempt to demonize immigrants for political gain.
So what is the, and I know this is a naive question, but let me just ask it anyway. What would the rationale be for the naming of these particular judges?
That's a great question. I mean, maybe because they're also federal. I mean, that JAG officers practice in the federal system. I'm not sure. I don't think that's where the Trump administration is going with this. I think they just want more military. They want more police state. Mm. Period. You know, right. Anytime there's like the immigration demonstrations. The pro-immigration demonstrations, I think, in lots of places around the country, but downtown LA certainly. You know, the knee-jerk reaction in D.C. and some of the other things that are happening in the country writ large outside of immigration, you know, they see a problem and they say, send the military. And then we'll just create more military. And any problem that comes up, we'll just send more military.
And one more thing before we open this up to everybody else, but what would happen if we didn't name these? I mean, it would just be a backlog, right?
Yeah, we haven't for years. There's been a backlog. The Biden, it's been growing exponentially. The Biden administration appointed a bunch of folks that were doing their jobs. The Trump administration tossed a bunch. This is actually sort of a standard protocol, especially for anti-immigrant administrations, which can be Republican or Democrat. It's sort of an issue that is bipartisanly problematic. It just happens to be more – the Trump administration takes it to new heights in its anti-immigration rhetoric and action. But, you know, slowing down the administration of immigration laws is not a new political tactic. It's been going on for a very long time. We haven't had comprehensive immigration reform for over two decades, and it's just going to keep happening until we have a Congress willing to change it.
Roger.
So I think the rationale in general, as Sarah said, is that we've had this backlog for years. I mean, I don't think anyone there may be some interest in having a backlog, but people who are stuck in the system, I believe, are in detention and not something we really want. I think the two things. One is that Sarah is right, that the Trump choice of using the military is a somewhat reflexive Trump choice. He likes the military. He thinks of it as his own. And there's no doubt that this is another way in which he's expanding the role of the military, which is something to worry about. On the other hand, he's also right that the immigration system is broken. It's been broken for many years. Congress has refused to fix it. The administrations, various of them, have refused to fix it. And this is another way in which he uses a problem that our political system has refused to fix and has become almost endemic, and he takes a radical solution, which I think almost always goes overboard, and yet it's going to be popular. JAG lawyers are good lawyers. I mean, I taught law school for a number of years. I had friends. I've had students go and become JAG lawyers. I don't have a problem necessarily with JAG lawyers, and as Sarah said, any lawyer can serve for, was it 4 months or 6 months?
Six
months. And so, there's a way in which one looks at what Trump is doing and says, good on you, in the sense that this is a problem. We should have these cases decided more quickly. We should not keep people in detention while they're waiting years for their cases to be decided. And I don't think the particular lawyers are necessarily bad. So in a lot of ways, I see this as one of those things where there's an argument for a basic Trump policy. But again, he goes too far. The way he does it and the way in which he sees the military as his own little tool or plaything is incredibly disturbing and dangerous.
I'll just add one piece to that, which is a lot of some of these cases are on a detained docket, but there's also undetained cases. So it's an attempt to deny as many cases as possible in order to clear the backlog and to get a ruling, I should say, on more cases. It's just more likely that by adding more lawyers to the government side without adding any government any lawyer assistance to the defendants, it's unlikely that people will win their cases. That's actually been well documented. You have like a 95%+ greater chance of successfully pursuing your lawful immigration claim if you have a lawyer. It's just that like over 90% of people don't.
Jay, we've got about 2 minutes, but certainly we're going to have time on the other side of the break, too.
Okay. Well, I'll start on a personal note. I never did watch JAG, and I had a reason for not watching JAG. Unlike you, I don't have a lot of respect for military JAG officers, and that's based on personal experience. I was on an assignment in, and I'll just do this story on this side of the break. I was on assignment at Fort Riley, Kansas, and most petty thing happened. I backed up my car. I was waiting for a parking space, and I backed up my car as a woman pulled out. And as a woman got in her car, I backed up my car. She rear-ended me pulling out of the parking space. We had to do an accident report and everything else. Weeks later, I get a summons in the mail. Now, I'm all the way back in New York. I get a summons in the mail to appear at Fort Riley, Kansas for reckless driving. And I called the JAG office, and I got on the phone with the JAG, and he said, well, this is after a thorough investigation, we determined that you're at fault. And I said, there is no way I'm at fault. This was a normal thing to do in a parking lot, to back up to get into a parking lot. We argued back and forth, and I finally said, I went into the office the next day. I was livid. And the my boss, the publisher, said, I'll make a phone call. And he called the congressman. And the congressman sent a letter to the JAG office saying, this is ridiculous. We have looked at this. This is clearly an unjust ticket. I'd like to know about your investigation, so on and so forth. And the next thing I knew, I got a letter dismissing the charges. And, you know, it left a really bad taste in my mouth as kind of the military version of small town justice. And that is why I'm so concerned about this, not about my stupid traffic ticket, but about this projection of power and control. And you're going into a system that really is stacked against you completely. So that's kind of the intro to my thoughts. But I have like five other thoughts on
okay,
this.
We'll get to the other five in just a moment. We're going to take a few moments to hear some news from the BBC. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, to add your thoughts to the conversation as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We already have quite a few letters. We'll get to those, continue our conversation, and then eventually move on to other topics as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break, some messages and news. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Tinsley Ellis providing our bumper music for the program this morning. You can find out more about the tracks and see the complete playlist by going to wamc.org/roundtable. We are discussing the fact that the Pentagon has planned for 600 military lawyers to backfill immigration judges. And we have heard from most of our panel this morning, although I yield the floor back to Jay Jochnowitz for a couple points that he wanted to make.
Thanks. So just to clarify that I don't disrespect all JAG officers and the model of the fellow who I had to deal with, and he was actually in Colorado handling a Kansas case, was one model. Then there's, you know, there's the Tom Cruise model and the Fred McMurray model and so forth. So
it just seems like maybe you got off on the wrong foot.
I did. We did. But and there's a part of me that would like to believe that there is honor in all the, you know, in the ranks and that they will approach their job honorably. But what we're, you have to look at it in the context of what's going on now. Firing generals and putting, you know, making sure that his own people are in, putting Hegseth in and so forth. And, you know, what I fear, and I don't think it's unfounded, is a military that Trump is remaking to his own liking, with a lot of people who are willing to do what he wants. And So that's, you know, this police state idea that both of my fellow panelists brought up is troubling. This idea that there's an aura of martial law. And it's not just the reality of what's legal and what's not, but it's also the feel of it all is scary. And I think it's meant to be scary. It's just meant to make the United States and its legal system, and particularly for now, its immigration system, but it's also its cities, its police forces, its day-to-day being on the street, all this is becoming scary for a citizen. And it's not, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, you got nothing to worry about. It's like, no, Congress had the foresight to pass the Posse Comitatus Act and say the military is not law enforcement. These are two different things, which, to just bring it to a close, is my final point, is that we were told that what the military is for and why all the DEI had to get out and everything else was to bring back the ethos of war fighting. Of warfighters. Well, what the heck are warfighters doing policing our cities? This is not what the military is for. And I hope all those arguments resound with the where it's ultimately going to go, which is the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that JAG officers, I mean, they have to go through a lot to get to where they are. I also have a lot of deep respect for the JAG officers that we've educated at Albany Law School, certainly. But I also have long-serving career military personnel in my family. And I have to believe and trust in the vast majority of educated, long-serving career military that they will stay loyal to the oath that they took over a king or dictator. And so this actually, as is often the case, and which is why practicing immigration law for 20 years has been such a wild professional experience, is that a lot of our problems really play out on a national stage, a lot of our historical problems as a country, when anti-immigrant presidents try to do, or governors or sheriffs or whoever try to do really, really unlawful things in the immigration system. It often reveals it calls and demands for the best of us to say and do whatever we can to preserve the foundations of our democracy. And that's not hyperbole. It just happens in this space over and over and over again.
Yes, go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, I think what Sarah is saying is really important. There are a lot of people in the military who uphold an important tradition of honor, legality, and respect. And there is a war going on, as both my co-panelists have said, against those people in the military right now from the top. But I think what's important to remember is that tyranny is driven not by ideology, but by criminality. It's the urge to be on the winning side. It's the urge to say, well, if I can get away with this, if I can win, if we can make it work, then it's okay. It's driven by greed and vindictiveness. And the real danger is that people who 2 days ago would never have dreamed of doing something suddenly today say, well, it's not so bad. And they do what people call coordination. They coordinate with the new winning side. They fall into line in important ways. And that's the danger that we're facing. And there are many people who are not coordinating. There are many people who are resisting. There's many honorable people in the military, in the police forces, in the bureaucracies. And yet there is a lot of pressure on them. And I think that one thing that many of us who are not in those areas, who are commentating or citizens or voting, what we have to do is we have to realize we have to defend them, and we have to understand that one of the reasons they can justify coordinating with things that they would never have done a month ago or a few days ago is that they see criminality, they see corruption on all sides, all over the place. And they're like, well, if everyone's going to do it, why shouldn't I? And so there has to be an attempt to really solve the problems that we are having. So, you know, whether it's the backlog in immigration cases, I mean, it's corrupt and it's crazy to not solve this problem. I'm not, and if you don't solve it, people are going to say, well, you know, then let somebody solve it. And if you don't solve the crime problem, whether it's in D.C. or Chicago or wherever, people are going to say, well, you know, these politicians are just not doing their job. They're corrupt. It's inefficient. And so it's easy to coordinate with the other side. And I think it's important for us to understand the real despair that so many people feel about our political system right now.
Let's get to a couple of letters. We have many, and we'll get to some letters before we take a break. Actually, I'm going to take care of about 60% of the letters with just this one, who say, the wine, but what will we talk about, is from George Bernard Shaw's 1908 play, Getting Married.
Ah.
It is spoken by Lesbia Grantham. I sent you the email, Jay, just so you have it for your record.
Thank you.
A cynical, rational woman who has turned down a proposal from the general, and we got several letters of that, so it appears there, and we'll assume that that matter is solved. Although,
who wrote that?
Shaw. Although somebody
no,
did.
Who was the letter writer?
Oh, Perry. Well, many, many people wrote.
Oh, they did.
We used Perry's letter.
Okay.
But we got a lot of letters.
Well, God bless them all.
I think all of them were said Shaw, except for one person that suggested it may be a Michelle Pfeiffer film.
Wow.
Wait a minute.
This is great.
This is the play is about a woman who refuses a proposal from a general.
Yes.
And she's described as what?
A cynical, rational woman.
Huh.
You sound cynical. Skeptical.
No, it sounds like it's perfect. Art imitates life.
There you go. So that takes care of a lot of the letters. Now we'll get to the stuff that is on point. We go to Joanne. Could the panelists give their opinions on why Congress refuses to deal with immigration reform?
It's not their refusal. We don't ask them to. I mean, we elect the wrong people to have the conversation. And then when they do have the conversation, we either divide into camps or allow ourselves to be manipulated by misinformation from the dominant party, which when this has come up has often been Republicans. So it's not like a bipartisan failure. It's a Republican failure. To be clear, and we fail to hold them accountable for it because we care more about the things that they shoot fireworks around during midterms and presidential elections, like, you know, are you going to be able to afford your groceries? These are not unimportant issues. It's a political failure on multiple fronts. Redirecting Americans' attention to our individualistic interests and away from the collective concern that we have in between elections when things really hit the fan.
Roger Berkowitz.
I agree with a lot of that. What I would add is that sometime in the 1960s and 70s, Congress continually started to stop legislating in a way that actually addressed problems and simply said, create a commission, create an agency, give over the power to administrative agencies. I'm just here... giving voice to the classic book on this by Ted Lowy, The End of Liberalism. And a lot of that was for money reasons, right? They wanted to be able to raise money from all sides. They didn't want to upset anyone. And so they don't want to take controversial votes. A lot of it is simply that there's this ideology that experts, PhDs, lawyers, et cetera, in these agencies are better able to make political judgments about these things than elected representatives. And so Congress began to give up its granted powers, enumerated powers in the Constitution, to actually make judgments and govern. You know, the whole premise of our constitutional system is that, as Madison argued in Federalist 51, that ambition must be made to counteract ambition, that each branch has constitutional powers and they must resist the encroachments of others. And for a whole host of reasons, mostly monetary and this ideology of expert rule, Congress has been unambitiously giving up its power to the executive for nearly 60 or 70 years. And it's gotten used to that. And it is a real problem in our system because without Congress working, the executive takes more and more of the power. And that's what's been happening for a long time.
Jay?
Yeah, I think, you know, we were talking about this on the break, that I think that everything we see, and to Sarah's point about this is a Republican failure, I think the Republicans are perfectly content with this situation. What we're seeing is exactly what they want. And it's the idea that they don't have to take, I started jotting down, you know, all the possible responses in a town hall meeting. Well, I don't necessarily agree with everything he does for the audience members that don't like what he's doing. For the audience members that do like what Trump is doing, it's like, well, yeah, I like what he's doing. And for people who would say, well, if you don't like everything he does, why don't you do something about it? Because you're a congressperson, they'll say, well, you know, it takes the whole Congress. I have other, you know, there are other people that don't want to do this. And we have a narrow majority. So, you know, it just takes a few Democrats to stop us or a few Republicans to stop us. And it's just excuse after excuse after excuse. So, yeah, they don't, as you pointed out, they don't have to take responsibility and they don't have to get any potential donors angry or potential voters angry. It's like be all things to all people and blame it all or on Trump and ride his coattails. It is an absolute failure.
We'll end with the words, it was an absolute failure. And we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll try to do better. We'll welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC. Panel at WAMC.org, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this third day of September. 49 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Wednesday morning. Let us go back to the letter as we go to Maureen, who says, why does no one talk about the fact that Trump was influential in not passing immigration reform under President Biden?
I did say that on the break. I didn't say it on the air.
Well, also, President Biden was influential in not passing immigration legislation under President Biden. I've had real problems with what happened under that administration.
Then we go to Paul. If memory serves, there was a bipartisan immigration bill ready for a vote, but 2024 candidate Trump weighed in against it and thus scotched it.
And it was the most cynical thing. I think you're right. I mean, Biden was, as we now know, maybe not in a position to really argue that as forcefully as he could have and lobby for it and push for it. And Schumer, I think, you know, kind of caved as well. And I don't think the Democrats carried the ball as hard as they could have. We wrote a lot about it. And I was furious when I was writing editorials about this because it was just so blatantly political of Trump to, you know, pick up the phone and say, don't do it. It's going to hurt my reelection chance.
Well, I mean, there's a silver lining in that it was bad reform. It wasn't good. The best shot was the Gang of Eight, which I always forget mm-hmm. where in the timeline that was. That was a more fulsome bipartisan good faith attempt to engage in comprehensive immigration reform. This isn't the first time. It's sort of like among immigration lawyers, we've talked about cynical and rational. We're a crew that's like, oh, this, like, we don't want to get Stockholm syndrome because it's like every single time there's a promise. There's been so many near misses, total misses, near successes on immigration reform that it's just, it has to be this is one of the areas that I firmly believe projecting out decades from now when we're in real democratic decline, not that we aren't already, that's going to eventually become a rallying point for Americans across the board. And until that happens, it's a political football. It's just too easy to hate the other. Mm-hmm. It's too easy. And our immigration laws started out as completely racist. The Chinese Exclusion Act is a law that was written with those words at the top in Congress. So, like, that's where you start. It's not going to get much better from there.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know everything that was in the bipartisan immigration law, right? And I'm sure you have, I mean, I don't know what you think was so awful about it, because I don't know what's in it, to be honest with you. I do remember that there were more immigration judges in it.
Yeah.
And that's at least something that would have prevented JAG, you know, this going on now. You know, I think that, as with so many of these pieces of legislation, if there's anything in it that we don't like, we try and destroy it. You know, yeah, what Trump did to simply win points in a campaign, because actually I think both of you are right, it was a very Republican-oriented bill, is he destroyed it because he wanted the political football for the election. That kind of cynicism and willingness to basically win at all costs is what I think is the kind of moral undermining of our politics right now. But, you know, at some point you have to pass bipartisan legislation. That's not going to be great for other side. I have my views. Everyone can have their views. You know, but the fact that we haven't been able to do it for a whole host of reasons under Democratic presidents, Democratic Congresses, Republican Congresses, is an indictment of the system. And it's the failure of the system which is causing the crisis right now, and that Trump is a symptom of, and also an accelerant of.
And just to give some context of the 2024 Act, on balance, it would have funded more military-type reinforcements at the border. It would have expanded the executive power to further narrow asylum protections, which are supposed to be guaranteed under both domestic law and international law under refugee protections. And it would have created a new border expulsion authority for the president. You have to remember this was coming right off of 2020 and COVID and Trump's justification, which was false and completely disproven from the beginning, about excluding, shutting down the southern border and excluding people as a health risk, which you might remember all the way back then.
Right.
So it was just, this was not fairly bipartisan in any way, shape, or form. It would have created, there were crumbs for immigrants in this bill, and for certain immigrants, including Afghan evacuees and others. It's just, it would not have done a bipartisan thing. It would have given immigrants crumbs and would have given $20 billion to other federal agencies to increase border management and migrant processing capacity.
It would have given the Democrats cover. It would have taken the issue away from Trump and the Republicans. And while it maybe only would have given crumbs, it would have prevented what's happening now, right? The renunciation of DACA, the sending back people from Afghanistan, Venezuela, Honduras, et cetera. And it would have neutralized one of the two or three worst issues for the Democrats and reset politics in the country.
But it wouldn't have, though. I mean, those all the policies that you're talking about, the expulsions that are based by that are by country designation, are TPS, which is temporary protected status. And this bill wouldn't have touched that.
It didn't touch it. But what I'm saying is it would have neutralized the issue of immigration to a large degree by reducing the amount of people coming in. And I think, as a result, there wouldn't have been the need to, to take these extreme positions, or wouldn't have been the support to take these extreme positions, because I think the issue would have been neutralized in a large degree.
All right. This letter from Kenny, who says, regarding JAG, why not? We need to adjudicate these cases. It's what Biden wanted to do with the border bill that Trump denied. Why not work together on this subject that everyone agrees with?
If you're working together to just get rid of more people who have been following, who have been following the laws, a lot of people in immigration court have been following the laws. And if it's just being done in order to shorten to reduce the number of claims that are available to people and to shorten the amount of time they have to put their case forward and to get rid of these cases as soon as possible, to pack more people in detention, mandatory detention. Because remember, ICE is now waiting in immigration court to haul away people who report lawfully for their immigration hearings mm-hmm. in order to put more money into the pockets of Geo Group and CoreCivico, who are the two main corporations who are building and running these massive detention facilities in the United States. If that's the role of this initiative, that is not a democratic, it's not even a constitutional exercise of power by the government.
No, it's a very militaristic one. Going back to the original point we made in this discussion, that, you know, it is a furtherance of the police/military state that Trump is building. And this is, you know, this is just one component of it with, you know, we don't hear his name as much these days with, you know, with kind of Stephen Miller in the background. It's also the idea. I mean, I hate to bring things back to the 1930s, but, you know, the idea that our judges are wearing uniforms now, I mean... They weren't even doing that in Germany, actually. They were still wearing the old white wigs, I think, back in the Reich system of justice. But they were agents of the state. They were instruments of the state, and that's the fear of this. And you talked about the idea of good people in the military and in other areas of government. And, you know, I made a list of a few of the people that's like household names around our house anyway. You know, Sally Yates, Alexander Vindman, so once in a while, James Comey will come up. And now Lisa Cook, is it?
Cook.
Yeah. These names are few and far between. And when they get in the president's way, when any of these people get in the president's way, you read about them being fired in very short order. So the intimidation factor for, you know, the people that it takes a lot of fortitude to stand up to this. We have congressmen. When they stand up, they also stand up and announce their resignation at the same time.
That's right.
To expect courage in the system, to expect people to say, "I believe this is an illegal order," is I
But that's why we have
I'm
to stop.
Hopeful,
that's
but...
why we have to stop relying on the external government leaders to save us. It's everyday people doing everyday things. Yeah. It's the conversations that happen in the hallways of our immigration courts that change things. I've had lots of conversations with government attorneys. I will never, ever name them. I don't even remember their names. To come to a reasonable, rational application of the law in a particular case or context. Mm-hmm. And same with immigration judges. This is going to happen. The real resistance is not asking, you know, or expecting a savior, but to start focusing on what you can do in your everyday existence to restore justice to everyday activities in this country.
We're going to go to a break. We'll go that way by reading Joseph's letter, who says, "Wow. Your show is definitely one-sided. If I listen anymore, I'm going to puke. Here's an idea. Stop whining." We will for a few moments as we go to news and other messages. We'll be back right after this. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A delight to have you with us 9 minutes past 10 o'clock. Let me just remind you who is on our program today. Sarah Rogerson, Albany Law School professor and director of the Edward Swire Justice Center at Albany Law School, editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer at the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz. And Roger Berkowitz joins us, making his debut as a panelist on this program, founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College. We are thrilled to have all this morning. We welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we have talked a little bit about this in our last conversation, so let's dig in and talk about what is happening as far as law enforcement going into the various cities of this country. Two separate stories that I will merge together because they do merge well together. One is this from the Washington Post that the mayor of the city of Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, has ordered indefinite coordination between the city and federal law enforcement officials, a powerful indication of her willingness to cooperate with President Donald Trump's effort to take over public safety in the capital city. Bowser issued an executive order that requires local coordination with federal law enforcement, quote, to the maximum extent allowable by law within the district. The order gives no expiration date. By law, Trump's federalization of the D.C. police force lasts 30 days and is set to expire next week. Bowser's announcement may quell any showdown over what happens after the deadline passes by authorizing continued coordination between the city and federal authorities. Meanwhile, in the Windy City of Chicago, resistance is the word of the day. And officials in Illinois are condemning the Trump administration for a planned immigration crackdown and influx of federal agents into the city, calling it a political stunt that will terrify residents and inflame tensions in Latino neighborhoods. There is no emergency that warrants deployment of troops, said Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, standing alongside other elected officials, including the mayor, Brandon Johnson of Chicago, and the state attorney general. He is insulting the people of Chicago by calling our home a hellhole, and anyone who takes his word at face value is insulting Chicagoans too. In the Oval Office on Tuesday, Mr. Trump was asked if he made a decision on sending National Guard troops to Chicago, and he said he intended to do it over Mr. Pritzker's objections. We are going in. So those are the two looks at two different cities of where we stand when it comes to troops taking to the streets of two of the major cities of this country.
Okay. So Pritzker's probably on good, solid ground to stand his ground on this and say no. I get that Muriel Bowser's advisors are probably telling her, this is a fight you're not going to win. And, if that's where she had been from the beginning of this, and that's where her administration had been from the beginning of this, I might not be so frustrated with her, but I'm terribly frustrated with her because she's been all over the map. One day she seems to be opposing it, and I think there were comments in the story from her about it, and the next day she seems to be full on with it, and let's see what we can do to work together, and then one day the police chief is saying this is a great thing, we could use the help, and the next day the corporation counsel for the city, or whatever the title of the chief legal officer of the city, he's taking them to court over this. And it's like Washington, has no consistency on this. And I kind of feel like if they had just said, formed a coherent position on this from the beginning that said we're willing to work with Congress on this, not the president, but Congress, it might have put Congress in the position of having to actually, do its job. Again, it's not the idea of reducing crime on what's likely to be a very short term basis. That's not the issue. Trump has been able to define it that way, but it's the issue of militarizing, the nation's capital and militarizing a civilian situation that's scary here. Ultimately, I think legal minds, I'm not a lawyer and I don't pretend to be, but I think ultimately what it's going to come down to is that the Supreme Court's going to be confronted eventually with all these various cases involved, stemming from Trump's emergency declarations of everything under the sun. The Supreme Court's going to be put in the position of having to define what an emergency is and say there are limits to what the president can do in his own mind in terms of saying this is an emergency. This is a crime emergency. This is a border emergency. This is a trade emergency. This is a, you know, fill in the blank, as I call it, you know, throw everything at the wall and hope something right. sticks emergency. So it'll be it's fascinating to watch, as you know, if you detach from the fact that it's your country going down the tubes. But great time to be a journalist.
Roger.
I'd say that you have to look at this in a couple ways. First of all, you have to admit that there's a problem. I mean, over Labor Day weekend, 58 people were shot in Chicago. 8 were killed. There were 32 separate shootings between Friday evening and noon on Monday. You know, you hear over and over again, crime is going down. You know, he's exaggerating. And, you know, we can play with statistics. You can, and maybe crime is going down. But if you, you know, in a way, he's trolling the Democrats and they're falling right into it. If you are going to normalize that kind of violence and that kind of disorder, you're going to lose. And I also think it's just wrong. The communities that are being impacted by this are often poorer communities, often minority communities. And it's a real problem. And I think it's not a, you know, and yes, Muriel Bowser is in a different position. But, you know, she also realizes that, carjackings have gone down 87%, as she says. And, you know, he's helping to restore order. I don't think the answer is to federalize the National Guard and put it into the cities, first of all, because it's illegal against the Posse Comitatus Act. And secondly, because I think it goes against everything about a country of civil liberties, a country of freedom, a country in which we rebel against a king or a tyrant sending the police into the city, sending the army into the cities. But if the reaction always is going to be there's not a problem, then it's just going to keep getting worse. We do have to realize that what really is going on here is an effort to take down a liberal elite that won't solve certain problems, whether it's the immigration backlog and the courts problem or the violence in our cities problem, because they're afraid of stepping on, you know, certain constituencies or doing certain things that, you know, some of their constituencies don't want to do. And if the politicians don't understand that they have to provide a safe and orderly environment for their citizens, unfortunately, there's going to be more and more pressure to take these kind of emergency-oriented, extraordinary measures, which will be devastating for the long-term freedom and health of the country.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, one can imagine, too, that Trump is laying the foundation for whoever he wants to succeed Bowser in office so that he can assert control on all levels, at all levels of government in Washington, D.C., around his, what do you call it, throne? I don't know. I'm like the idea.
The seat of his imperial power.
Yes, thank you. That's those are the words I was looking for. Because yeah, what is she supposed to do? I mean, and you know, she's throwing out there, you know, could you maybe not wear your masks? Could you maybe not mask these federal agents so that we know and identify who the federal agents are in our communities? Like, she's asking for as much as she believes she can without retribution, which is potentially immense. I mean, anybody who's been in and around D.C. understands just how forcefully present the federal government is throughout all of those communities just by virtue of real estate and other dynamics involving, you know, socioeconomic status, divisions of communities. DC's a complicated place.
Yeah.
But this is a pretty clear signal and maybe a projection on my part, but I think not too far off of not just a federal takeover, but a Trump takeover of the capital of the United States in order to retain power indefinitely, not just for the next 3 years.
Would you have a problem if J.B. Pritzker called out the Illinois National Guard to help with policing? That's legal. That's not against the Posse Comitatus Act.
That would be interesting to see what would happen.
I mean, you have to take this problem seriously. And the problem is most mayors of big cities right now and most governors in these states are not taking the problem seriously. And that's what's leaving this issue open. Now, you know, we can have an argument about what it would mean to take it seriously. You know, there's one side, you can totally defund the police and try and create social services and welfare and things like that. I don't think that would work, but it's certainly, you know, something that one could argue. On the other side, you know, maybe you actually do need a much more vigorous policing. I don't know if that's the right answer either. But someone's got to take these issues seriously.
What are the issues? What issue are we talking about? Because that's what I'm having problems with. We started off with the word crime. Yeah. And in Washington, D.C., it was crime. And then it became homelessness. And now with what's happening in Chicago, it's being done in the name of immigration. So this has tentacles and it's moving out. And so it is problems. But where they all come together is where I'm having trouble figuring it out.
And the level, you know, when you say taking seriously, I think it's the level of seriousness. Trump defines everything as a crisis.
Right.
So this becomes, you have to have a huge solution. And what Pritzker's doing is what he needs to do it better, I think. And but we also, as a people, need to be able to hear it. What he has said is, A, crime is going down, and he's right. It's not where it should, where people would like it to be, but that's fine.
I think that's the problem.
No, I'm saying it's fine that people have that perception, and that is something that is always the case in every city, in every town in America. When you get politicians involved, they stoke up this level of fear, and people buy into it regardless of what the statistics are. But that's not to say that Chicago doesn't have a problem. I saw that statistic on how many people were shot over the weekend. I was like, that's a lot of people. Pritzker offered a new argument here, and it's not just the crime itself. It's illegal guns that people are using to shoot each other. And when you have people in Congress who are saying, let's reduce all gun laws in America to the lowest common denominator and honor concealed carry permits from state to state to state, and you're going to have the same people carry the same ability to carry a gun in Chicago as you do in rural Florida or rural upstate New York. Well, New York's not a good example because the laws apply everywhere. But there are states with very liberal gun laws, very open gun laws. And the pipeline from the southern states to the northern states has to be addressed. All those things have to be addressed. That's why you have this flood of guns. And I think we've given up on that problem partly because of, and this goes kind of to the immigration problem, is that when Biden came up with a gun solution, which was kind of a meh, they said this is the first significant gun reform in decades. And it really wasn't that great. And it didn't do anything about the pipelines of both legal and illegal guns. It didn't do anything about straw buyers and all that. So that's what they're dealing with in Chicago, is this flood of guns. And that's how people shoot each other. So Pritzker is trying to redefine that and say your problem isn't that you need more cops on the street. Your real problem that needs fixing is your gun laws.
So
that's not taking it seriously. That's going beyond the simplicity that Trump is offering.
Let me say that I agree with you that I think the gun laws in this country are crazy and that I wish guns were much more regulated and much harder to get. I think that's posturing by Pritzker at this point. If you're the governor of a state or you're the mayor of a city like Brandon Johnson, you have to take what you're given, right? And you have to figure out a way to keep your people safe and to allow people to live a life where they can walk down the street, have their children walk down the street, take a subway, and not feel like they're in danger every time they walk out of their house. Joe, you brought up a really good question, right? You know, well, is it crime? Is it, immigration,
homelessness,
yep, et cetera? Well, I think it's all of the above, in the sense that, you know, I mean, I ask a lot of my students, right? I have a lot of students, you know, when you see somebody jumping a turnstile, does it bother you? Right? I mean, I live in Manhattan right now. Every time I'm in the subway, there's two or three people jumping the turnstiles. And they're like, no. Well, it's you know, and there's this broken windows philosophy. We can argue about it. It can be racist. It can be this. And I think it is. It's often racist. And yet we have, because of the fear of being racist, right, which is something we should try and avoid being, we have begun saying, well, it's all right when certain people or some people or when people break the law, because we don't want to, like, and this is the same thing. We don't prosecute misdemeanors in certain cities anymore because, you know, it's racist or whatever. But if you create a sense in which lawlessness and disorder have become accepted, I think people feel, not only feel unsafe, not only are unsafe, but they feel like the system's not working. They feel like it's not a world that they want to live in. And that's the kind of corruption of the sort of elite governance that I see as an utter failure and has led to the despair that leads people to say, I'll give this guy a chance. And if we're not willing to get serious about really saying, look, everyone's got to follow the law, that's the rules, then I think this is going to continue.
There was an important court ruling yesterday out of California.
Yes.
That I think is really
Los
important.
Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where a federal judge ruled that when Trump sent National Guard troops into Los Angeles over the summer, that violated the Posse Comitatus Act. It's an initial shot, you know, across the... I hate using war analogies. It's an initial ruling. Let's just reduce the violence in the language that
we
use. But like, so the question about Governor Pritzker is interesting because, for lots of different reasons, because it's, I understand the intellectual consistency of the argument about political elites, but they do wield this power, and the power isn't always necessarily in how they use it, but what results. And I think it's an interesting question, because if we have military against military, I'm not sure, and maybe the two of you might know better, when in the history of this country has that happened? And what was the result? And is that something that we want? And what are the consequences?
Well, it's called the Civil War.
Well, aside from that, though, right? In modern America, have we seen heads of state deploy the federal military that is within their control against the federal military under the president's control? And that's why, to have a federal judge saying the governors do have this power, not the president, sets us up for what?
Yeah.
It's a great question. We're going to leave it there for a moment while we take a break. We'll be back. We'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. First, some messages and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning, the 3rd of September. And we welcome you. Last call for letters, Roger Berkowitz, Jay Jochtowitz, and Sarah Rogerson making up the panel this morning. We have a couple more issues that I would like to get to. on the program this morning. We go to, unless anyone, did anyone have any other issue or any other point they wanted to make about the crime in our cities? All right. Then we will go to the Epstein files. This is here we go. The move, House Oversight Panel releases some Epstein files as pressure mounts. The move came as Republican leaders press colleagues not to force a vote on disclosing all the material. Most of what was released on Tuesday was not new. A top House committee released more than 33,000 pages of records on Tuesday that the Justice Department had turned over last month in connection with its investigation of the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. It's Madeleine Kahn and Young Frankenstein that makes me have difficulty pronouncing that word every time, because she accentuates it when she says it, and it's in my brain and I can't get it out. As Republican leaders toil to tamp down pressure in their ranks for more transparency, the release of the files by the House Oversight Committee, the chamber's chief investigative panel, have been expected. Many of the documents were public court filings, and it was not immediately clear whether they included any material the Trump administration had not already made public. We did talk about this at some length yesterday, but victims of Mr. Epstein are talking to those at the House today, and those discussions are taking place. So all of that and a letter that I just received moments ago from a listener who said, I just have to find it. Taking us to task for not, why are you not discussing the Epstein files and the victim speaking at the Capitol this morning? This is the most important news of the day.
I have been saying for weeks, whenever this topic comes up in my house, that how did we get from a conspiracy theory to a mainstream political issue? I don't know, but I think the Democrats, I think the left is putting a lot on this. When Democrats find themselves in the same on the same side of the argument as Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, I think they need to take a step back and say, is this really where we want to be? I think a lot of hope is being put in what we haven't seen, and you know, there's all these other things. And I'm as tantalized as the next person about this. The idea that Trump doesn't want the stuff to come out. The idea that it was on Pam Bondi's desk, supposedly. But I when I listened to her, I think she misspoke. I think that's also a possibility. I just feel like this issue is so, with all respect to the reader, to the listener, I don't think it's the most important story of our lifetime.
I've struggled with this from as it started to recirculate from the very beginning, because I just couldn't quite understand where we were at, of why this, in the sense of if there was something really there that was in there, that
it would have come out.
It would have come out. We would have known about it. And it's hard to believe also, I think, in given, and again, and this is no disrespect to the listener, and I certainly respect their point of view, but I do think there are many, many topics that are...
And if everything was true about what we suspect about this, it would be a huge story. But, you know, I've seen a lot of stories come and go in the newsroom, and an editor would simply say, where is your proof that this is a story? And it's like, well, I don't know. And they say, and how long have you been looking into it? Now, if I said I've been looking into it for 5 years, the editor would say, and you've come up with nothing? Could you please cover this meeting?
Right.
There's also we get a lot of letters when this story is on the docket, higher up on our docket, because it happens to be the lead story across multiple news outlets. And the feedback with multiple letters has been, why are we talking about this ridiculous distraction from the larger stories involved in the crumbling of democracy in America? So I suppose, you know, this is a symptom of the a couple of things. One, looking for a big break that will take down Trump. I think everybody needs to get real comfortable with the fact that that's not happening. He's a convicted felon.
Who was reelected.
Who was by a majority of Americans. So that's a reality we need to start living with right now and not place false hope in some sort of grand gesture of the Constitution. The grand gestures of the Constitution are now a lot more gnarly, for lack of a better term. I mean, that's why we're quoting the Federalist Papers. Like, we're going back to the foundational documents of this country, because that's how off the rails we are. And a list or a fact from a long ago prosecuted case that multiple Netflix documentaries are airing on as we speak. Like, that's where you get your fix on this in terms of wanting to know more. But if we're going to be serious citizens, and I'm not saying that the person writing in is not a serious citizen. I'm sure they are because they're listening to this program. But to be a serious citizen means weighing all of these stories, and the ones that we spoke about for an hour and a half, I would argue, are way more consequential for the future of democracy.
Although we have respected panelists on this program who will argue and have argued to me that because of this story, the other things are happening because they're being used to distract us from this story.
Fractured attention. We all have
it. The collapse of democracy is being used to distract us from the Epstein story.
Well, that,
with all respect to the respected panelists,
in the sense that the actions that are taken sort of out of the blue, mm-hmm. that those are being done to bring us down another path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think that does happen sometimes. That things it does seem that something pops up out of the blue whenever the Epstein case gets a little too uncomfortable.
I would love it. And who wouldn't love to be proven wrong about this? Would that this is the story of the century and saves us all for years and years? But the bottom line is, then we end up with, like, what, J.D. Vance as vice president? As president? Like, what? Stephen Miller's still going to be there.
Yeah.
All these people are still going to be there.
We have to think it through, don't we? Roger.
This is not an issue that I've spent a whole lot of time on. I don't know why the listener that wrote in thinks it's the most important issue, right? There seems to be two reasons. One, which we've talked about, which is some people seem to think it's going to bring down Trump. And I agree with Sarah that the chances of that are pretty minimal. The other, you know, is the reason that it's been on the back burner for years is that it's going to bring down sort of the corrupt liberal elite, right? I mean, this is the right wing conspiracy, right? That all, you know, that there's thousands and thousands of, you know, lawyers and professors and business people who've been on this island and it just shows the corruption of the entire governing class. I don't think either of these things are going to happen or are true. To me, the larger lesson that I take from this, to the extent I can draw anything meaningful from it, is that there's this demand for transparency and truth, that somehow the truth shall set us free, that if the truth comes out, everything else will fall into place. That's not usually the way it works. There are things more important than truth, like justice sometimes, right? That there are sometimes to let out let's say there are people's names on that list. They haven't had due process. They haven't had a court. There are institutional legal reasons that you don't release all the information because it would unjustly put people's names out there and have, make them have to defend themselves in a way that they've never been charged. There's also friendship. There's also a sense of that you just don't drag people's names through the muds without you know, proof or something like that, unless they've done something wrong. And so, you know, this idea of truth over everything, which has become the mantra of some people, at the expense of privacy, at the expense of just, you know, hospitality or good manners, and legality and justice, is to me one of the lessons from this case that I draw.
I don't think that the administration is doing it for the really good reasons that you outlined. The idea of being accused of something without being, had your due process is you know, everything Trump is doing with character assassination. But I agree with you that if the administration came out today, but this isn't an administration that can take that position because that's not how they operate. Well, character assassination's the phrase. To come out with the idea that we're doing this for justice. And
I'm not saying Trump is saying that, but I think the legal system, which doesn't want to release some of these cases, is a meaningful has good grounds for not wanting full transparency.
You know, I will say that, I mean, one thing again to our wonderful panelist who's brought this up is in this particular case, it was because today was significant because we finally hear from the victims. And it was the day that they were going to be meeting with the victims. So I do want to make that point. Galen writes to us and says, what the Epstein files expose is how both high-powered Democrats and Republicans have abused children, and those in power do not want it to be exposed. Please make it clear. I knew you were going to get a letter on this, Sarah. Please make it clear that Trump was elected by a majority of those that voted, not a majority of the American people, as was stated. Amended. There may be more stories that are more consequential for our country than the Epstein file stories, but Trump is the one that made this a part of his campaign for the White House, not the Democrats. If you're bored hearing about it, tough. There are quite a few young women that were harmed by Jeffrey Epstein.
I don't think anyone's bored of hearing about it. I mean, again, that's why there are currently several Netflix documentaries on the subject. A lot of people are consuming this information, and I'm not sure it's for the, justice to be restored to the victims. I appreciate the point, though. And certainly anytime that victims have a platform, it's important to pay attention to that for sure.
So a couple letters regarding stories from before. John said earlier email said, asked you to stop whining and said the show should stop whining. How about the same for Trump? Man, he can whine. That's from John. And then
was that two Johns? Was it the original?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. I don't remember. I apologize. Lisa says Trump has repeatedly shown that he has no interest in governing. All of his evil and hateful immigration tactics will do nothing to help our desperate need for immigration reform. Trump's border czar Tom Holman said as much on a recent New York Times podcast. His entire plan for media coverage and to display strength with no regard to human suffering and community devastation. Furthermore, why aren't the industries who hire undocumented workers facing penalties?
That's a good one.
From Lisa. Then,
well, they are. They are. And it's that's another source of frustration when I read about this, because years ago we had a vigorous debate on the editorial board about this, and it was the Verify app that was out there at the time. And this I'm talking about a conversation that was probably about 15 years old now, and back then E-Verify was not that good, and it also wasn't mandated for use. Now it supposedly is, but now they're saying, well, E-Verify has all these mistakes, and employers are shocked to have a raid and say, I used E-Verify. I don't know what the problem is. And it turns out E-Verify has its faults. So we had called for this years ago for employers to also be held accountable. Once the employers stop hiring, people will stop coming across the border, but you have to enforce that.
I'm going to read a letter, but first I'm going to ask you a question, Jay, and I just want you to keep this in mind as I'm reading it. And it is not cynical on my point, and I'm not trying to diss the listener, but I want to ask you, as I'm reading this, just tell me whether you've ever received a letter like this in the newsroom at the Times Union. Here we go. You are also the media, and you're failing just like the major networks. And while lamenting and hand-wringing, you failed to report on the people in the streets trying to protect democracy. This weekend, thousands upon thousands of people across the country used the holiday weekend to protest. Shouty caps. There were several thousand protesting in Hartford, Connecticut, with Senator Blumenthal and Connecticut Attorney General Tong, political union activist leaders from at least a half dozen resistance organizations speaking on and supporting resistance to Trump. Many people celebrated the Labor Day weekend with protests supporting the labor movement, opposing billionaires, and resisting Trump's fascism. It is pathetic that you are not reporting on these demonstrations. I was out defending democracy. Where were you, panelists?
Yes, we've gotten a lot of letters like that and phone calls. And, you know, this has been a complaint from any number of sectors of the public for years, that we're not out covering every demonstration. So we cover a demonstration 1 week. The question is, what's different about the demonstration that's happening the next week? Is it more people? No. Is it fewer people? If we say that, then people get angry at us. Any number of things. Is it news, as opposed to a community note, an observation that something is happening in the community? And it's a decision that editors have to make every day. I am not a working news editor anymore, so this is not a thing that I do. I tended to go to demonstrations at the Capitol.
Pass the buck, Jay.
I'm just saying that because I'm not making the decisions now. But when I did make decisions like that about what the Capitol reporters would cover in particular, we went to demonstrations at the Capitol sometimes, and sometimes we didn't, because it's another demonstration in Albany. Albany's a seat of state government, and a lot of people demonstrated, so we didn't cover every single one. And it's the same thing with this. My wife she goes to demonstrations. Is it newsworthy?
I don't know the answer to that, other than I actually saw pictures out of Connecticut, and thousands of people. It's impressive.
Yeah. Demonstrations are important.
They're important, and to see the numbers, mm-hmm. and to put it into a context, and for people who, I've had conversations with people over and over again that say, I feel like I don't know what to do. I feel like I don't. There's nothing to do. And then when they go to a protest, they feel as if they're doing something, that they're with like-minded people, mm-hmm. who are trying to do something. Yeah. And if that's all you get out of it, mm-hmm. and hopefully there's more, but if that's all you get out of it, man, that's pretty damn good.
The New York Times covered a number of demonstrations in the aggregate, saying, the byline, it says Labor Day protests denounced Trump while supporting workers. The demonstrations were part of the continuing effort by Trump opponents to try to pressure his administration, even if many events were modest in size. So there's an attempt to put all these groups together. And I think there's a big mistake that folks make. And I've attended protests. I've represented people who have protested. I've observed protests in my role with the National Lawyers Guild. I've taught how to inhabit those three different roles. And I have to say that there's a mistake that some people make who center their own participation over the issue at hand and the effect of their participation on that issue. And I'm not saying that that's what this particular listener is doing, but I've seen that dynamic play out largely as a function of social media and the desire to be seen as a resistor as opposed to actual resistance?
You know, I think the challenge here, and, you know, with respect to what the reader's saying and what many readers have said, and I get it on my Facebook page a lot, too, is there a way to cover this? So I was impressed the way Rachel Maddow handles it, for example, that she simply says, here was a demonstration, here was a demonstration, here was a demonstration, here's footage from all these demonstrations. And it's just bang, 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 bang. It's a reminder that this is happening. It's an alert that this is happening. I mean, this is what news does without sending a reporter to do a 15-inch story or a 20-inch story on every single demonstration. So my question, I guess, and is kind of introspective to my industry and my paper as well, would be, how do we cover this in a way that is both within our limitations of staff and time and space, and in a way that doesn't make us advocates necessarily, which is what the difference between what we would want to do and what Rachel Maddow would do. And, you know, it occurred to me as I was listening to this discussion that, you know, I was saying that, well, there's a demonstration every day, there's a demonstration every week or whatever. Well, there's also a society event every day. And yet we used to devote an entire page to that. Every, you know, some days of the week or one day of the week or every day of the week. When the Saratoga is going on, we had a whole section on social events and stuff like that. So why aren't we covering demonstrations, which are a whole lot more important than a fashion show, with all due respect to fashion people?
There's a lot of research out there that shows that around the world, countries that are having democratic crises, the biggest and most important block towards moving towards a kind of tyranny of some sort is civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience. I don't think that's the same as protests, right? I think protests can be helpful in the sense of feeling like that there are other people who feel like you do, and I think that's important. And so I think it's important to encourage the courage to be active and even be willing to partake in protests and civil disobedience. I think that's going to be an absolutely essential part. And we've seen that, whether in Los Angeles or elsewhere. I think there's a difference between civil disobedience, in which people are really risking themselves to stop what they see as an illegal and unjust action, and protests, which is, you know, a way of speaking your opinion. And I think both are important. Both have long and proud political histories. And we should be encouraging them in any way we can.
It's a yes and situation. And also, you know, historically, civil disobedience actions have also been covered in a way that emphasizes the disobedience over the message, right? There's a lot of valid critique in that feedback in terms of how the press covers powerful resistance movements. But, you know, transitioning from protest into a different form of resistance that has been historically proven to be more influential is the next move.
We are out of time. I want to thank all of you. That was a really enlightening and terrific discussion. I thank you all so much for being part of it. Roger Berkowitz, will you come back?
Yes. Excellent. If you'll have me.
Okay. Well, you made the cut, sir. Congratulations. Jay Jachnowitz, Sarah Rogerson, thank you very much. Always wonderful to see you. We'll talk soon. More show coming up.